Hello, I'm marine biologist Nadia Frontier, and welcome back to Ice World, featuring conversations that I recorded when I was in Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey. I'll just mention that if you're enjoying the podcast, please do subscribe or leave a review. It really helps us to get more people listening. This episode will feature two interviews with two of the most important people at Rothera Research Station, the people who keep us fed. I'll be speaking to summer chef Sive and winter chef Katie. As you'll hear, we don't actually grow food in Antarctica, so almost everything we eat is either frozen, tinned, or powdered, making life of an Antarctic chef particularly challenging. Let's hear my conversation with Sive Moore first. We recorded this on her last day in Antarctica in April 2022.
So I'm here this evening with Sive, who is Sive 5?
Sive rhymes with five. I often introduce myself with 1, 2, 3, 4, Sive.
She is an excellent woman chef here for the summer season. Sive, would you like to give us a bit of background?
Yes, thanks for having me, Nadia, on your podcast here in Rothera. Yeah, I'm just coming to the end of my 6 months here, literally tonight, leaving the ship tomorrow. And I suppose, what do you want to know? I mean, I've known about Bass for a good 10 years, and I kind of thought, oh, I'll never be able to work for Bass because I'm not a good enough scientist. They actually came recruiting at my university over 10 years ago when I was studying geography at the University of St Andrews. And then I kind of have ended up being a chef working in food sustainability, and then applied for the job because I thought, well, it's a climate change research institute, so hopefully they'll appreciate that my niche and interest is food sustainability. So I've been down here working as a chef, hopefully trying to bring a bit of that food sustainability ethos here.
Let's talk about that. What kind of elements of food sustainability have you brought into Rothera cooking?
Well, my background as a chef is mostly in vegetarian and vegan cooking and using seasonal and local produce where we grow our own. Not exactly something we're
possible,
doing here.
Yeah. We don't really have any allotments or any gardens around here.
But I'm very interested in preserving, and it's been really amazing learning about the produce that we do get here and what we can use frozen, you know, ingredients I've never used before, like defrosting avocado and asparagus, and then learning how to use dehydrated onions and things like that. And then optimizing for flavor, and especially for vegan and vegetarian foods, how do you get your balance of like proteins and nutrients and the array of nuts and things that we have, and then incorporating, you know, working with different allergies, and we don't have a hospital here. So really considering like dietary requirements, and it's been really an interesting, challenging season, and it's been so inspiring to work with some amazing other chefs here as well.
Excellent. Do you think it's been difficult? Because at home, you're used to working with lots of locally grown produce, as you said, and you know the origin of where it's come from. But now, you don't actually get the opportunity to order the food. You are working with the ingredients that you have. Has that been a challenge, or have you taken it as a new welcoming, like, I don't know,
something
challenge?
That you just,
a new challenge that you've then had to take on. And
It was definitely a challenge. I didn't really know what ingredients we were going to have. I was aware it wouldn't be fresh. And we do get freshies, and then you have to sort through it and figure out the best order in which to use those ingredients, and sometimes preserving things and chopping up and then freezing yourself. I'm really looking forward to seeing what the winterers do with the last batch of freshies they get in 2 weeks after I've left. I'd actually really love to be here for that, to see, you know, I know some people are really keen to make sauerkraut. And even when I was interviewed, I was talking about preserves and pickles and sauerkrauts and fermenting and sprouting and what the limits are to those processes you can do. Like, I was, you know, even in my interview, I was curious, can you sprout things, or is it against the Antarctic Treaty to like have sprouts? Because I know like the Australian base have hydroponics, and obviously we don't here. But yeah, I'm really interested in like how you get flavor and texture and diversity of nutrients. Like, you have more B12 in like fermented produce. And like kimchi's and pickles, that's why historically we've always eaten those things. We kind of crave fermented foods. It's good for our gut and our gut microbiome because they're alive, and like sourdough breads with yeast. And you know, I was always curious, can you even make sourdough and stuff?
So eating an ecosystem, but we can as a result of that. So we're not allowed to sprout things, but we are allowed to make sourdough, and there was a culture of sourdough that was taken over from the Sir David Attenborough, and we did have some really good sourdough bread. So where do you take your inspiration from cooking? What are the roots?
I'd say definitely my family. My parents, I didn't realize until later on in life, are eco-gastronomes. They just always grew their own veg, kind of alternative vibes that they have. They kind of dropped out a bit from London society and just grew veg in rural Ireland and always preserved and pickled and, you know, dehydrated and bottled things. And yeah, lots of vegetables, really working with the seasons. And obviously we don't do that quite so much here, but there's always a level of seasonality. I mean, you know, at Christmas you're using more of your red cabbage and, you know, just pickled things that are kind of spiced or, you know, different things like that. So
And the frozen Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, lots of Brussels sprouts and chestnuts at Christmas. And
it's amazing how good frozen stuff can actually taste.
Yeah.
I think it's the chefs, because if I was just to make something, I'd probably steam some veg, but I find the chefs can just put some incredible flavours with them and roast them in a certain way and use like toasted nuts on top of it or seeds. It just changes the totally.
It's been so interesting, like, seeing from the other chefs and the way that they cook a thing. Like, we all got into cooking the asparagus straight on the hob, which is like a big kind of flat kind of griddle pan. And you can just char the asparagus and it gives it that kind of barbecue flavour. And then I started doing it with the asparagus and with the Brussels sprouts, sorry. I've already said asparagus. And I did it one day with the courgettes and then made this, like, courgette and peach, charred peach and like goat's cheese and pea and mint salad, but we didn't have any fresh mint, so I used like mint sauce, and it's like inspired by Hemsley and Hemsley, the Hemsley sisters, Jasmine Hemsley's salad. So yeah, trying to make salads with frozen and tinned vegetables and fruits has been really interesting.
It does actually feel like you are eating fresh food, and then I remind myself that none of this is actually fresh, but it is so exciting when you get that fresh food order and you have everyone in the kitchen like taking out all the moldy fruits and not contaminating the box. So how many chefs do you have in the winter and how many people are you cooking for
in the summer? We had 4 chefs. We had the previous overwintering chef, Katie, who's amazing, such an inspiration, and then Olivier joined a bit later on, so he's going to be the overwintering chef for this next season. And then there's me and Valia and Danny just for the summer. And Danny left by like March, and V is staying for the next couple of weeks. And then, yeah, so we all overlapped because there was 160 people. And actually V had to leave kind of last minute to go and work on the ships because of the whole COVID situation, and one of their chefs couldn't come down. So it's been kind of musical chefs, as it always is here, musical all careers.
Musical chefs.
Yeah, in and out.
And how many people, what's the maximum people that you've ever cooked for?
I suppose I've done events for... I did once do an event called Feeding the 5,000, which is like using food surplus and food waste for big events in London. We did one at Mercato Metropolitano, and maybe that was only 1,000 people, but using produce that they've gleaned. So they take stuff that would otherwise have been ploughed back into the ground in farms, like wonky parsnips, and people go and volunteer and pick it, and then volunteer at this big night where they all peel these wonky parsnips and you make a huge parsnip soup. And there was loads of basil from an aquaponics farm that we made into pesto, and loads of surplus bread. So 50% of all the bread produced in the UK gets wasted every year, every day. 50% of all the bread in the bakeries.
That's
half of all bread.
Insane.
It's an insane statistic.
50%.
Because it's a daily thing. We expect fresh bread every day. So that's why there are brands like Toast Ale, who I've collaborated with in the past, who make beer out of bread. And when you work in food waste and you get surplus, or you work with organisations that work with homeless people and they get food donations, you always get loads of bread, which isn't the most nutritious, but we make a lot of bruschetta, a lot of crostini, a lot of like panzanella, bread salads, like bread pudding. So you're always trying to find uses for leftover bread, which we have here as well. So yeah, so I've probably cooked for like 1,000, but with loads of people, and coordinated my own events for like up to 250 people at the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cooking, or like weddings for like up to 200.
Wow, but actually daily, day in, day out, having your job, cooking for 160 people.
That was quite a challenge, yeah, when you're kind of chefs on your own. Yeah, well, you'd have a mid-shift and the chef would be helping you, but you're like planning a menu for 160, so trying to scale up the quantities is really hard. Yeah. You just really don't know how to predict how much people are going
to
eat. It's like complete guesswork, really.
So talking about food sustainability, do you have any tips or nuggets of information that you would, or recommendations that you would like to pass on to the British Antarctic Survey, ways they can improve? Being down here, it's obviously extremely challenging getting food down here. A lot of the food is out of date because it has been sat in containers for a long time. It's always difficult to plan for years ahead how many people there are going to be.
Yeah, Definitely, I see that they're making strides in the right direction, and they have the environment team are really on it. And there's been some research recently by a master's student, I think, in Cambridge, looking at the carbon footprint of different foods. But I think it's really important to join up that academic research and theory and the background and the work that the chefs are actually doing on the ground, the practical like application of that theory. I hope they're really going to reduce the amount of red meat. I know that the Icebreaker Cafe in Cambridge, in the headquarters of Bass, they have recently decided they're not going to serve red meat anymore, and they're going to have like meat-free Mondays. There's loads of things that could be done down here, and so I think that will trickle down to here. I think they could have a meat-free day. I think they could encourage a lot more meat-free meals and have that explained to people coming down.
Yes, I agree with that, because we do cater for vegetarian and veganism here, and there is a wide variety of vegetarian foods that are available, but there is a culture that if you were to do a vegetarian exclusive only day, there could be quite a bit of uproar from the community here. It's a mindset that also needs to propagate and be changed, but you do that.
Yeah, my last meal yesterday, I did a lunch that was vegetarian and no one seemed to complain. I mean, I did use a lot of cheese, but we did cheese toasties. But who can complain with a cheese and onion toastie? So
imagine doing a whole vegan day.
Yeah.
That would be a challenge. And Sive, what are your best moments and experiences that you will take away from Antarctica?
The cooking has been amazing, and the things I've learned in the kitchen. You always learn so much from your colleagues and from the other chefs, but I really love the science talks by all the scientists and the things we get to learn. That was something I was so excited about coming down. And then, of course, on top of that, the real adventures, like learning to ski and snowboard, has been amazing. It's a real work hard, play hard place, if you want it to be. I mean, you put in a lot of effort. Definitely the kitchen team works really hard. You can't get away with not working. You have to produce food for 160 people. I'm proud of some of the meals I made and some of the fun theme nights and knowing that people really enjoyed it. And
what were your theme nights?
I did a beach night the other week because I thought it would be a bit tropical and bring in some warmth as we head into winter, and people came back from winter trips, so everyone was wearing shorts and flip-flops. And
sunglasses.
Yeah, we had a little beach scene made out of like food dye and some sugar and like palm trees made out of white chocolate. And then we had also a retro theme night. That was Zoe's idea. Like 70s and 80s music and like Spam fritters and like Black Forest Gatto and like retro foods, chicken marbella. That was really fun.
Wow,
so
Spam fritters.
Yeah, knowing that your community are happy is really the aim of when you work in hospitality and food, and like knowing that we make our own fun here, and so anything that brings the community together, and food of course brings community together, so yeah, working in food is always fun like that.
It's a beautiful ethos. What will you take away from here?
How to hopefully be a better cook and calmer cook and able to use diverse ingredients, different equipment, work with different people from different backgrounds. I'm really knowledgeable about like how to get bacon crispy. Like just cook different meats. I hadn't really cooked much before because I'd worked in vegan and vegetarian places. Hopefully I better cook with meat and like how to defrost stuff well, planning in advance. All of that stuff that you really have to plan here because you've got to defrost it. How to like rifle through a reefer. I call it reefer diving when I have to go digging in the reefer.
So the reefers are like these massive containers that are kept at
minus 18. It's kind of ironic. The coldest you ever get in Antarctica is in the freezers looking for food. That's where I wear all my like deep polar kit and gloves, in the freezers getting food out.
So you've been an amazing energy and such an inspiration for this station, and I really like what you said that it's important to be aware of the community and keep everybody happy, and that is the food is such a massive morale boosting through the station, and everyone rejoins at meal times and from working outside, and maybe if they haven't had a great day or they're doing laborious tasks that just need to be done, the canteen is like this incredible place, and you just bring so much energy and joy to it, so it's been so lovely having you here this summer.
Thank you.
And I really love
such a joy to be here
having your ethos, because I think this is something that does need to propagate more and become acknowledged. It's almost like because we're in Antarctica, things are a little bit backwards here, like in terms of
you take what you can get.
Yeah, we are limited in how we can adapt and change, but this should be a turning point, and I think you've brought so much, and your book to conclude, let's talk about your book, because you're going to leave a copy here.
Yes, the first author's copy was sent down to me here on the Sir David Attenborough ship. Very proud of that. While I was here, I had a book published called Sustainable Kitchen with my best friend and business partner, Abby. You would love her. You'd get on so well with her. She's just a ball of energy. And we wrote that in lockdown, and it's all about how to be more sustainable in the kitchen. And so we even brought some of those techniques into the kitchen. And yeah, you, Nadia, inspired us to. We had a night where we made some of the beeswax wraps from it. So we're all interested in the kitchen at looking at, like, how can we reduce our, like, use of cling film. And we do have some good methods in the kitchen, like tubs with lids. And, you know, we're always thinking about how to save water down here and how to use less energy. And yeah, all different elements of sustainability around food systems, not just, you know, the carbon footprint of the foods we're eating and the packaging that unfortunately all comes in and how the distance it comes. So yeah, Sustainable Kitchen is out now as of April 5th, 2022. And there's a copy going to be left here in the Rothera Library. I must remember to do that.
Your legacy will continue. Perfect, Sive. Thank you so much for talking to me on your last night.
Thanks for having me.
And that is Sive, who co-founded The Sustainable Food Story, which you can check out on socials. Together with her business partner, Abby Glencross, their book Sustainable Kitchen is full of projects, tips and advice on how to shop, cook and eat in a more eco-conscious way. Since Antarctica, Sive has spent a year working in camp management and remote food logistics with a conservation NGO in the heart of the Congo rainforest in the eastern DRC. She is then due to go to Iceland to be involved in base camp management during an expedition. Pretty cool life she lives. Our second conversation is with Katie Rum. Katie Rum was the winter chef during my time in Antarctica and responsible for feeding 23 people on a daily basis and up to 170 people during the summer. With some 20 years of restaurant experience behind her, she previously owned 3 restaurants before leaving London to take her culinary experience to the Alps, the Isles of Scilly, and then on a yacht sailing from the UK to the Caribbean. I asked Katie how she ended up in Antarctica.
While I was working on the Isles of Scilly in the afternoon, I'd sit on the beach and just think, okay, well, what's the next place I want to work in? And you just start looking at places where you want to be. And Antarctica was one of those places. And then I started to see that they actually take people on, like chef roles and all the rest of it.
That's really interesting. I think contrary to quite a lot of people that found the job advert and then it made them think about Antarctica, you thought, where do I want to work?
Yeah.
Found the place and then looked for jobs accordingly.
Yeah. I mean, to work just surrounded by snow has always been something. I've got a strange love and want of being snowed in. So to come here and not quite get snowed in yet, but at some point
you want to be locked in a building.
It's and just not always been a dream of mine to be snowed in.
Then you wouldn't be able to access the snow because you'd be stuck in.
I know, but in a warm it's building. Just yeah, you just want to be yeah, just surrounded with a lot of snow and mountains and obviously the sea as well. So this kind of ticks all the boxes.
It's a lot to do to cook lunch and dinner every day. So can you just explain a little bit about the structure?
Yeah, I mean, I make a menu plan at the beginning of the week, so I know roughly what I want to do. And sometimes you have to ad-lib a little bit because something might not work out or someone else has cooked a similar thing the night before, so you can swap it and change it around. But then, yeah, just sort of moving stuff around, getting stuff, sort of meats and various things defrosted, fish out of the freezer for the week, and then just working on prep each morning for that day or the next day.
And you have help every day with somebody who is essentially a kitchen assistant washing up. And
they come in and do all the washing up and then they can help with a little bit of cleaning and or some of the prep. Certainly coming up to the weekend when we'd have like a nice big meal, they'll help with all the prep for that. So they get to do a little bit more cooking, or some of them just prefer to chop vegetables and not sort of cook so much, and other people want to sort of try and make bread and various other things. So
do you enjoy having that variation? Is that quite different to something you've experienced before, whereby here essentially you are your own team, just you with that person who's washing up? But I imagine in restaurants you've got a pretty consistent team.
Yeah, obviously you've got the same people that you work with, not every day in restaurants in London, but you know, you mix up the teams and you have different days off and stuff. But obviously everybody knows exactly what the other person's doing, whereas here you have to sort of keep an eye on people and just sort of watch if they're okay doing what they're doing, because they're not obviously trained chefs. But it's nice because I'm not a team, I'm a one person in work here, whereas lots of the other groups are all like there's two of them or there's a team. So what's nice for me is to have a different person each day, you have different chats and different banter and everything, and then, you know, they come up with different ideas as well for various things.
Yeah, it gives quite a bit of variation to your day. That's nice that you're not just alone in the kitchen, and also for the person that washes up, at least from my perspective, I really enjoy taking a day out of my working routine and come into the kitchen, and you just feel like you're productive and achieving in a different way. And it's cleaning the toilets is not so glam, but
no,
we've just run out of our fresh fruit and veg. We've got one box of potatoes.
Yeah.
So do you find this actually a massive challenge to make food every day? And you manage to create such variation, which I'm amazed by, with actually tinned and dried food.
I don't know, you just have to think about it a little bit and then sort of think outside the box. Like, obviously, to have fresh tomatoes on freshly made bread rubbed with garlic is a very simple but delicious meal.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have any of that here. So you just have to think, well, I don't have fresh tomatoes or fresh coriander, but I'll do this, that and the other. And you just try to do the same, but different. Just rework it.
Like the cheese is frozen, a lot of it. So sometimes like the goat's cheese, that can go quite into a crumbly mess.
It's like sawdust, isn't it?
It is like sawdust. You taught me to blitz it with cream, which is just, it's actually ingenious, all these little strategies that you have to do.
Well, certain things like cauliflower, that's quite nice roasted up, or, you know, just flash fried. But then it's all about spices and getting different. Like tonight I made the five spice to go with the cauliflower, and another night I'll do it with paprika, smoked paprika. So it might be a similar dish in its cooking style, but it's got a different flavours because you're using different herbs and spices.
Yeah, so it makes it seem like the cauliflower has just got so many different lives and so many different forms.
Yeah.
And the broccoli, I think when the broccoli is steamed, it actually tastes like real broccoli, like fresh broccoli.
Yeah.
Which is weird. It's either that I'm losing my taste
yeah.
and I've forgotten what fresh food tastes like, but I genuinely don't miss... I miss salad because that's something you can eat cold, but in terms of vegetables, I think you managed to achieve that.
When we ran out of salad in the summer, we were using cabbage as salad.
Mm.
And people, like in the sandwiches and in the rolls and everything, people just didn't seem to... I think people just...
Adapt.
Yeah, they just adjust. They see it. And if it's colourful, they will eat it. And that's where I try and do those little tricks like removing the skin off the broad bean.
Cause yeah, frozen broad beans.
The frozen broad beans look like little lumps of grey... ness, and then once they're peeled they look like fresh green.
It's deceiving
deliciousness.
It's like you've just gone and picked them from our local allotment,
mm-hmm.
which we obviously don't have. Where do you get the inspiration from your food for when you're making menu plans?
I've got no idea, actually. It just comes. I just love reading books or being online looking at stuff. Like sometimes I'll just have an idea that I want to try something, and then it either works or it doesn't. It's something I just don't stop thinking about when I'm working. Yeah, you're just always thinking, well, I'd like to try this, or that would work with that. You know, after working in restaurants for, 30-odd years, I've got lots of things that I've cooked and lots of different things that I've done. And obviously, you can't cook them all in one go, but throughout a summer, winter, summer, you know, it's amazing how the memory can remember something. You go, oh, yeah, I'm going to try this dish that I did years ago.
So. Yes, a lot of creativity. So when you're on your day off and you're just going skiing, are you thinking about new recipes that you could rustle up?
Sometimes. It might come and go in my mind. Yeah, normally I'm thinking about other stuff if I'm out skiing. That's that's a bit of a sacred time for outdoor thoughts and everything.
Or maybe you're dreaming about recipes. But
sometimes I'll wake up in the night and I'm like, oh, that doesn't go with that. And then I'll be like, no, you got to do it. And then you go back to sleep. But that's not new for here. That's just something that's just always been. I just think, you know, if you're always creating stuff, that's how your mind works, isn't it?
What's really cool is that because we all get to be with you once, one day, maybe every 3 weeks, a lot of people want to learn what you're cooking. Mm. And there's always like, wow, how does Katie make that? Or when we do our cook days on your days off, we want your recipes and make what you've made for us. So you're like our inspiration. It's like you're like our mum, actually, a cooking leader in a good way. What ingredient do you find is the hardest to maintain?
Getting the bread and flour all the time is like, it always seems to change. I think the atmosphere, when it gets dry, the bread or certainly the cakes will go dry or drier. So that's always changing. And it's really difficult. When I was trying to teach Ed the other day to make bread, I just can't teach it because you either know to put a bit more liquid in or you don't.
It's like an instinct that you can't pass on.
Yeah. And I'm sort of saying to him, well, if it does this, do that. But every day, not every day here, but most weeks, it will change.
So you're varying the ratios according
So what might happen one week doesn't happen another week. And I can't teach that, do you know what I mean, to somebody else. So, which I think Ed finds a bit frustrating because he obviously wants perfect buns every time. But
and he thinks that you're, he's put you on a pedestal and he just,
he thinks I'm sabotaging his loaves. But no, it's just, I have tried to explain this. Like sometimes things don't, like you said about the cheese, some things you go to make something that you've made a million times that you know is delicious and it just doesn't work because the product has been frozen or it's been a long time getting here.
Yeah, like it just hasn't maybe preserved.
Has been a long time being here. I mean, I was opening some eggs the other day to make some cakes and one of them, when I cracked it, was completely black inside.
Oh, no!
And I absolutely screamed.
Because I just thinking it was alive.
Well, I just, I thought maybe there was a chicken in there or something. I don't know what I thought, but I wasn't expecting to see a black yolk, and I just screamed. So, yeah, you never quite know what you're going
to
get.
Do you crack each egg into a separate bowl and then add it to the mix?
Yeah.
Because wouldn't it be disastrous if you cracked a bad egg into a massive cake mix?
That day I was making, three frittatas. They take 16 eggs each pan. So, yeah, if you got to the last egg and it was the black one that you threw inside, then you'd be
You've lost 16 eggs. Talk to me a bit about your winter trip, because I'm quite fascinated to learn that that was your first time properly camping. Mm-hmm. And what a place to camp.
I know.
Antarctica.
I know. I'm not a natural camper. I like a nice hotel room. I like my tea on a tray. That's what I like.
Loose tea.
Yeah, loose leaf tea, but I like a spoon of Earl Grey and a spoon of breakfast tea. It's got to be the right blend. But JB did a great job of making me tea with Nido in it every morning when we were camping out in the field. So
almost replicated the perfect blend.
Almost, yeah, and sort of served, just handed to you rather than on a tray. So it was kind of the same as being in a hotel. What are you laughing
at? It's just funny.
And then obviously waking up in a sleeping bag that's just absolutely soaking wet because it's just been so cold all night. It was really cold. It was like minus 15 outside, but for some reason the inside of the tent was really, really wet. So that was really nice.
Really nice?
No.
No. All your condensation.
Yeah.
Keeping you nice and moist.
Yeah. But then, I don't know, I must admit, for the first 24 hours I thought I might not see this through the whole week. And then, I don't know, as with all things, you start to get into it and then you're just loving it.
What was your best memory from that trip?
My best memory is on a day when we thought the weather had just completely bombed out. The other two boys had come back on their skidis because the weather was too bad to climb. And I said to JB, can we just take the skis and just like ski from the tent so we don't get on the skidoos and we don't do anything, but we just ski from the tent. And the weather was atrocious. It was really, really like cloudy. So we went off, we had the GPS so we could see where we were going, and all of a sudden the cloud broke and we just, all the mountains were just lit up in sunlight. And it was just like the clouds had just been parted for us just to ski, but cross-country ski on the flat. And we just did that for ages. And when we got back, even JB said that was one of his favourite days.
Something so simple. You don't have to necessarily go down. Or some people have been skinning up peaks for hours and hours. And then they get like a 10-minute run.
Yeah.
So actually, I think it's quite a nice way to prolong it over flat ground.
Well, it was so good. We did it the next day as well.
And you're quite a pro skier. How long have you been skiing for?
I learned to ski when I was at school, and then it was just something I got really into with my Swedish friends, and we would just ski all the time, do ski seasons in Chamonix for like 6 months.
6 months? Mm-hmm. Wow. Like, how old were you at that point?
I was about 21, 22.
Cool.
So I'd work all year as a waitress, save up all my money, and then we'd just go and then ski. We didn't work or anything, we just skied.
Wicked.
And so...
best way to live.
And yeah, learning to ski with Swedish girls is the way to learn to ski, so...
All listeners, note that. Learn to ski with a Swedish girl. Is that one of the biggest attractions, then, to come
Swedish
to Antarctica?
Girls.
No. Learning the fact that you've learned to ski and skiing has been such a big part of your life for such a long period of time.
Was just as simple as that. The snow, because I've been back to Chamonix many times and just spent weeks and weeks and weeks in the mountains. And I'm very happy to do that on my own. It's great doing it with friends and family sometimes come out. But I can be in the mountains on my own and not, you know, I'm fine. Do you know what I mean? I absolutely love it. But I don't know, there's something just so peaceful and beautiful about snow. And mountains, ice. I mean, I haven't seen many icebergs until coming here. I'm just very content when I'm surrounded by snow.
Katie Rum, Antarctic chef. It seems that Katie is hooked on the Antarctic lifestyle. Since we wintered together in 2021, she came back to Antarctica in 2023, continuing her remote chefing in another British Antarctic research station, Halley, for the summer season, before then undertaking another winter at Rothera. She is truly remarkable, and if that wasn't enough, Katie then returned to Halley for the 23-24 Antarctic summer season. And after the station closed its doors, she then went back to finish the summer season at Rothera, where she is right now. I've actually not managed to see her in the UK since 2020. If you do fancy Katie's job, do keep an eye out on the jobs page of the British Antarctic Survey's website. Please subscribe, review, and tell people about this podcast. Next time, for International Women's Day, I'll be chatting with the head of the British Antarctic Survey, Professor Dame Jane Francis. I'm Nadia Frontier. Thank you for listening.